Hi, welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Posnanski, and with me is Chris Sale. Michael Schur. Michael, welcome.
I entered my name as Chris Sale in our like chat room thing that we use for this podcast because I haven't. We'll get to this later, but I haven't had as much fun watching a pitcher pitch for my team since Pedro, probably. I think that's the last time it felt this fun every time the guy pitches. It's pretty amazing.
Insane.
Yeah, he's insane. He's like two or three times in the last couple of years, a batter has swung and missed at one of his sliders, and then the slider hit him on the back foot. That's incredible. But that notwithstanding, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. Quite an honor to have you, Chris Sale, on with us. Very excited. We're going to be talking baseball. I haven't done this in a little while. You're kind of busy these days, aren't you? Fairly busy.
Yeah, this is the most busy sort of stretch of my year. We're in shooting The Good Place season 2. We've shot 11 out of the 13 episodes, and we're sort of dealing with the finale now, and it's a very stressful time. But it's never too stressful to waste an hour talking about meaningless stuff with you over the internet.
And nothing could make me happier. The only thing that saddens me about all of this, about you being so busy and all this, is that being a huge Good Place fan, as everybody knows, you know what's going to happen already. You know, it's like, and I have no idea, and I'm going to have to wait, and that stinks. You know already.
I would actually say it's better to be in your position because there's nothing more enjoyable to me than watching a movie or a TV show that I like where I don't know what's going to happen and then watching it unfold. Like the absorbing stories that way is the most fun aspect of engaging with entertainment, I would say. I mean, it's obviously a lot of fun to make it too. I'm not saying I don't like my job, but I was a huge fan of The Leftovers, and The Leftovers had that feeling of like, you just don't know what's going to happen. And I like the kind of joy that I got out of the last season and the last few episodes in particular watching that show. It's just like, you can't recreate that. It's a specific thing to like fandom of a show or movie that has sort of twists and surprises and sort of uncertainty baked into it. You know what I mean?
It is true. I actually remember, and you talk about movies and TV shows, but also for books, I remember getting the last Harry Potter book and, you know, just dying to know, all right, where does this thing go? Where does it lead? I mean, how is this going to happen? Of course, there was all of these rumors of all of these big surprises coming in the book and so on and so forth. And you're right. I have no discipline. So if somebody had actually said, hey, I know what's going to happen, I would have asked them to tell me and it would have completely ruined it. You know, I mean, the experience of actually seeing it unfold the way it unfolded is so cool. So yeah, I do kid about that, but it is interesting that you already have done what will, you know, the next half year of my life and many other lives will still be figuring it out, but it's done. You've already done it. It's over.
Yeah, well, it's not totally done, but it's about to have been done. future passive participle, is that what tense that is? I almost invented a new verb tense. It is about to have been done.
It's about to have been done.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's thank our sponsors. We have two. We'll just do the one up front. Of course, want to thank Blue Apron for sponsoring the podcast. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. I'm gonna throw a little Blue Apron fact at you there, Michael, just something I've not told you before. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. What do you think of that?
Oh, I knew that already.
That was something that was just obvious to you from the start.
No, I knew that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, sure. Of course, we get Blue Apron here at the house. Michael promises to start any time now, probably after you finish filming, I would imagine, after you finish making The Good Place. That's right when you dive into your Blue Apron time, right?
That's right, yeah. I'm saving it for when I'm really done, when I can really concentrate on it. That's right.
We get Blue Apron here at the house. It's wonderful. Every week, a box of fresh ingredients show up with the recipe cards. We make the recipes of family. Very cool. And you can do this for free. Thank you to Blue Apron. Just what you have to do is go to blueapron.com /podcast, P-O-S-C-A-S-T. I guess it's forward slash. Is it forward slash?
Yeah, it's one of these things that, like, people who are like computer nerds will snicker and yell at you all the time because we grew up, when the internet first showed up, we all said backslash, but it isn't backslash. It's a regular slash. It's a forward slash. Yeah. But you, everybody still says backslash. And if you say backslash around like hardcore computer nerds, they'll be like, like they'll it's like a classic blunder for computer people. That you say people say black side, yeah. I don't care.
I don't either. It's some sort of slash and then podcast, P-O-S-C-A-S-T, after the blueapron.com, and you'll get your first three meals free. Great deal. So there you go. Blue Apron, thank you again. You know what I decided to do? Well, first of all, there's two things that I did. One, do you have a commissioner you made the call this week? Do you have one?
I don't, because the season of the regular sort of rec league that I was, of which I was the commissioner, ended
a
while ago. Yes, I was the commissioner. That season ended, and my son has been playing on a travel team that's been in these different tournaments. I am not the commissioner of that travel team. There is no such thing. I am the official scorekeeper, though. I keep track of the games. There's an app called Game Changer that allows you to score games like on your phone. It is so fun and great and wonderful. And I do miss a little bit the old fashioned scorebook scorekeeping, but this app is incredible. It's really, really great. And it allows you, obviously, like it automatically kind of keeps track of stats and stuff. And this really fun thing happened where I did the scorekeeping for both the rec league team, the sort of main, you know, pony league team that he played on, and then also his travel team. And for the pony league team, this is not a you make the call, but it's in the similar vein, so I'll just tell you the story. The team got off to a really hot start. They were like 7-2, and then they lost three games, or 6-2, and then they lost three games in a row. And part of the fun of obviously like youth baseball is that everybody gets to play, right? And you're swapping in, you're subbing in people, and there's these rules like no kid can sit out, you know, two innings before every kid has sat out at least one inning and stuff like that, all this sort of fair play stuff, which is the way it should be. But what happens is, you know, there are 12 or 13 kids on each team, and it's a little bit of a puzzle to try to figure out how to, you know, when to sub people out and who to play when and where and how and why. So going into the playoffs, there were only five teams in his division, and going into the playoffs, I decided I was going to try to moneyball the playoffs. And I sat down and I looked at all of the stats and stuff that had been gathered over the course of the 10 or 11 games that they played in the regular season. And I came up with a sort of moneyball strategy of how the team should lay out over the course of the four. Usually it's like a 2 hour maximum playing time. And in, you know, a 9-year-old baseball, that means you're playing like four or five innings because the innings are long. And there are 5-run cap per team per inning, et cetera, et cetera. But I moneyballed it. And I said, like, okay, so here's the way I would play these guys at these positions. And I would sub out, you know, these people then. And I would start this. These are the way the pitcher should go and all that sort of stuff. And so we had lost three games in a row. And then going into the playoffs, a team that we had lost to 10-7 in the final game of the season, we played in the first game of the playoffs and we won 20-3. And then and then we played in the championship game for the 9U division, and I did the same thing. And and going into the last inning, it was 9-9. Our team got off to a huge lead. It was like 9-1 after two innings. Then the other team like chipped away. It was 9-9 going into the last inning, and we had a huge 2-out rally. There were first two kids got out, then the guy reached on a sort of infield hit / maybe an error, and then was stealing second when my son came up and lined a single in the center and knocked in what ended up being the winning run. It was a huge thrill. It was wonderful. And I also felt like 99% of it wasn't the kids or the head coach. It was really me. That's what I, it was me. It was me and my stat based analysis of like organizing the way that the team should be playing.
Well, I've been saying this forever. Moneyball does work in the playoffs. I think this is proof.
Moneyball does work in the parentheses, rec league, 9 and under, pony league, like mid Los Angeles, youth baseball playoff, and parentheses playoffs. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Well, it's not quite a you make the call, but it's still good. It's still very good.
Yeah.
And I have one, but I'm going to save it for. I have one, but I'm going to save it for next time. I don't want to give our listeners too much. You make the call.
Are you crazy? What are you talking about? Save it. There's no save it for next time. This is a long, rambling, pointless podcast. We do everything here.
Here's how it went. So a friend of mine emailed me this question, and it's a good one. It's a fun question. Okay. So again, his son is probably maybe a year or two older than your son, maybe 10, maybe.
Okay.
I think. So he's right around the same age. He might even be the same age. And he sent me this thing. His son, I don't know if his son was the one playing shortstop, but somebody on his team was playing shortstop. Runners on first and second, nobody out. Okay. So runners on first and second, nobody out. Ground ball to the shortstop.
Okay.
He, of course, wants to go to get the lead runner, but the guy on second, the kid on second base, didn't run. He just stood there. He just stood at second base. So, but the shortstop still did the fundamental play, threw the ball to the third baseman to get the force. For the third baseman threw it to first to get the double play. All right, so that's how it went, and that's how it was scored. So the question then was, obviously, you don't expect the runner not to run, but the question was, could the shortstop have gone over, tagged the guy on second, stepped on the bag on second, and thrown to first for a triple play? You make the call.
The kid was actually standing on the second base bag.
He was standing on the second base bag, never moved.
I don't think he could have, right? Because he has the right to that base as long as he's the lead runner. So he could, if he's just standing on the base, the kid running from first to second would have been out, and if the throw had beaten the batter, he would have been out. But I think that guy has the right to second base.
You are correct. Look at you. That's because you are a commissioner. You're correct. That's right. The runner on second is safe as long as he's on the bag, as long as there's not two people on the bag. Now, the guy who was on first had run over to second and they're both on the bag, the lead runner is then out.
Right.
But because he was standing on the bag, you could not tag him while he was on the bag. Look at you. This is because of your multiple years of experience as a commissioner.
That's because of my now nearly 35 years serving as a rules-based commissioner at all levels of baseball, from youth all the way to the majors.
I'm thinking you are the Joe West of commissioners.
Well, you know what's fun is that my son, you know, is obsessed with baseball, and he sort of had grown out of the first wave of baseball books that we got him. And so we just did another kind of round of like a slightly more sophisticated stuff. Like, you know, there's a book about the history of the Dodgers Giants rivalry. And since he has betrayed me and become a Dodger fan, he's poring over that. But one of the ones we got was a sort of big, big, juicy book about like sort of the history of equipment and rules. Like, you know, here's what a catcher's mask looked like in, you know, the turn of the century. And here's how, you know, here were the rules in 1876. You know, it was seven balls for a walk and six strikes for a strikeout. And, you know, there's pictures of like at Scheib Park where the crowd was sitting on the field having a picnic in the outfield and stuff. And he's getting really into the rules of the game, unsurprisingly, given his dad. And it's so fun to talk about because he's like worked out now the infield fly. He pretty well, he's worked it out. And so he was in a game the other day, bases were loaded and no one was out, and there was a pop-up to the pitcher, and he yelled infield fly to just in case the ump didn't know that it was an infield fly. He yelled infield fly, and it was the correct call. So it was pretty great.
That's awesome. Now, how high does a fly ball have to be in ninth year old, you know, mid Los Angeles youth baseball to qualify for an infield fly? I mean, could it just be like a little bloop?
Right? It has to sort of be, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's a rule, but it has to be. It's anything judgment. Anything except a line drive is going to be called an infield fly. Basically,
that's what I think. Yeah, that's the way it should be. All right, we are going to because this is the second thing that I've done. I put out on Twitter that we were about to do this and asked if anybody had questions. You know, give our readers a chance to be a part of this podcast. That's really all we're trying to do, right? No,
that's not at all what we're trying to do. But I'm fine doing it. I mean, I have no problem actually doing it. But that's not what we're trying to do.
I see no problem at all. So I've done it. So we have a few questions. So we're talking baseball, and we're going to start off with Alan Sepinwall. Blech. Alan. God. All right. Alan Sepinwall is our resident Yankee fan. Who's been on the show to talk about the Yankees. He has two questions, so we're gonna build off of that. But first, since this is kind of the Yankee Minute, I'm going to play our scary Yankee music here. Here we go. All right, that is scary.
So scary.
All right. So Alan has two questions. Obviously, they're both specific to the Yankees. One is, what kind of hex did you two cast on the Yankees? That's his first question, which obviously we're not going to handle at all.
Nope.
And the second question that we will handle, I think, can you discuss the Aaron Judge, Jose Altuve photo that is making the rounds, which you have seen, I assume? Yes.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it.
Okay, so if for those of you who have not seen it, I don't know who that would be. They're just the Aaron Judge is standing next to Jose Altuve, and Aaron Judge is 200 feet tall, and Jose Altuve is 2 inches tall, and it's the most amazing contrast. If you see two players, awesome players, standing next to each other, the huge size differential. It really is. You know, even though you know one of them is a Yankee and all that. That's an awesome photo, right? I mean, it's really pretty cool.
There are three things about it that are awesome to me.
Okay.
Thing that's awesome, number one, is every year, if you watch the Little League World Series, at some point there is that exact photo. Because yes. In the Little League World Series, the age cutoff is 12. And there is, at 12 or 13, obviously some young boys are on their way to becoming men. And have gone through certain changes that have led to huge growth spurts, and some boys have not. And so what you get at some point in the Little League World Series is a photo of a base runner leading off first base or standing on first base who is 4'3", and the first baseman is 5'11½". And
right.
it's always wonderful. It's one of the best.
Wonderful.
It's one of my favorite things about the Little League World Series is you get that every year. And seeing 6'7" Aaron Judge stand next to 5'6" Jose Altuve, 5'6" being very generous, 5'4", 5'2", 5'1".
Well, but I'm saying even he says 5'5".
5'5", right.
Even he concedes 5'5".
It was like, oh my God, that's that photo. That's reason number one, it's great. Reason number two, it's great, is because there had been a photo taken of me and my son at the baseball tournament he played in that was not dissimilar from the way that photo looked. I was in I had like all the sort of dads and coaches have like honorary jerseys of the team. So I was in that jersey and he was in his jersey. So it kind of looked like we were cut off at the waist. I was cut off at the waist. So it sort of looked like I was on the team and he was on the team. And I was like, oh yeah, that's what that looks like is me and my 9-year-old. So Aaron Judge is the dad and Jose Altuve is the 9-year-old. But the number one reason it was awesome is because if you go to any stat page, you will see, for example, on ESPN, Aaron Judge is number one in the AL in wins above replacement at 4.8, and Altuve is fourth at 3.8. So you're talking about two of the three or four best players in the league. And the idea that the baseball can accommodate and be and that the players who are both 6'7 and 5'5 can both be the best, essentially the best player in his league. That is the best. I love that so much that it's like this is a game where you can be amazing at either height. It's such a wonderful thing about that photo.
It's so great because I really was thinking, if you look at that photo and you see, you know, Aaron Judge just towering over Jose Altuve, and they're both kind of happy, and you know, and they're both in their element, and you know, both are confident players and all that sort of thing. You look at those two and you think to yourself, if I'm a GM, which player would I rather have? Like, which player would I
great actually, question.
You know, it's a great question. That's the thing. And you probably would take Altuve, right? Because of the history. I mean, Judge is a little bit younger, but he's not that much younger. He's only a couple years younger. You know, Judge is maybe a more of an impact hitter, but Altuve plays the field. Not that Judge is a bad fielder, but Altuve is an infielder. It would be really close. I'd happily, you know, that's one of those that I say all the time. You take whoever you want. I'll take the other guy. That's fine. But you might take the small guy. You might take Altuve, and that's awesome. That's just so great. You would never, like, if you had, in other sports, if you had two great players and one was huge and the other was small, I mean, football's different because the huge guy would be probably a lineman and the smaller guy would be a quarterback. So it's different. They're playing different positions. But generally, you're like, I love Chris Paul, but I'm going to take LeBron, you know? I mean, you're going to take the bigger guy. But baseball, it doesn't matter at all. It's not relevant in the slightest. They're both great players despite their size. I mean, I love it.
Yeah. I think you take Altuve, but boy, it's close.
It's so close. Right.
I think you take him because the position he plays is probably slightly more valuable, although Judge is a great fielder, and because he now has a track record of having done this for 4 years or whatever.
That's right.
Judge looks like you know, he's going to be in the Hall of Fame, but it's also half of 1 year, and you don't know the legal adjust and, you know, whatever. But yeah, that's what's crazy is what you're saying is basically, instead of taking the guy who right now, if the season ended, wins the triple crown in the American League, you're probably taking the 5-5 guy.
I know. It's awesome. It's so crazy. Awesome. And it would be. That would be such a fun thing. I mean, if you really had to make that choice, because you'd be betting on Judge. If you took Judge, you'd be betting on Judge. He is a little bit younger. He's a couple years younger. And you'd be betting that this is real, that he's going to do this forever.
That's
which
right.
He might, you know. But if you're betting on Altuve, you're betting on a much longer track record and just the all-around play of the guy. I mean, it's so great. I could not love that picture more. All right. We're really not going to talk about the Yankee slump, because that is the guarantee that they're going to win 27 in a row. So we're not
We're
not even going to talk about it.
Just the fact that you brought up the fact that we're not going to talk about it means we already talked about it and now they're going to win.
No. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, that's the way this works.
All right, fine. Just fine. They're going to win 27 in a row. I'm sorry. They're the Yankees. I don't want to talk about them anymore. All right. Evan has this question. Is it wrong to be kind of glad that the Jays are terrible again because I'm used to them this way?
he's a Jays fan, this guy?
I don't know. The great thing is I will only give this the information that I'm getting right here. So
okay, wait. So read it again for me. Read it again.
Is it wrong to be kind of glad the Jays are terrible again because I'm used to them this way?
Okay, so I'm going to say he's not. I misread it. I don't think he is a Jays fan. I think he's saying
not
like,
a Jays
I'm
fan.
Like he's probably like I don't know what he is, but he's just like I'm in his memory. This is a nostalgia play for him. He's saying, I am used to the Jays being terrible. I didn't like that period where they were good. I'm happy they're terrible again, just because it fits my conception of what the Jays should be. That's what he's saying, right?
I think that's what he's saying. That's how I would read it. It could be that he's a Jays fan, and maybe that's why he's asking if it's terrible, because if he's not a Jays fan, well, who cares, right? It doesn't matter. Maybe he is a Jays fan, and he's kind of like, I kind of like it back in the old days when they
I like being good. Miserable. Yeah.
I like being miserable and there were no other fans and I get to like have them to myself and all that.
Well, I don't know. I don't like that they're terrible. I think it's kind of bums me out. I like Toronto is a cool city. It's a cool team. City. They've had some really fun playoff moments in the last
super
few years.
Fun. My God.
Yeah, like I'm not personally taking any pleasure in the Blue Jays being terrible. I will say that there is a they have personalities on that team who rub people the wrong way, right? So I can understand I can certainly understand like being like, ha ha ha, you got what's coming to you kind of thing. Cause they're not the most lovable bunch of guys. Like really. But I'm shocked that their hitting has collapsed the way it has. I mean, that team is terrible. They can't hit. None of them. I mean, the Red Sox have been in a home run drought. They're last in the AL in home runs and like 27th in the majors or something, which is crazy. But they're still, you know, they have like the sixth best team batting average, and their OPS is like top 10 in the major. It's a little bit of a fluke, right? This doesn't feel like a fluke to me with the Blue Jays. They just can't hit. Justin Smoke is their best hitter, and it's not close. I mean, there's no one like everyone else on that team is having a terrible year, and I don't totally know how to explain it. Do you have like a theory on this?
Yeah, they're a little bit they've gotten old. I mean, I do think that. By the way, I don't know why just saying Justin Smoke makes me laugh, but it does. There's something about that name that makes me laugh. They've gotten old. I mean, that's really the heart of it. The thing about baseball is, in my view, and really all sports, I'll say this for all sports, players just get older. Got old way faster than you think they will. You know, you think, oh yeah, he's 32. He's got three or four more years. 32, he could be done already. You know what I mean? I mean, 30, you could be done. And so you look at that team and look, is anybody surprised that Jose Bautista's not really hitting? I mean, he's 36 years old and Tulowitzki's 32 and even Donaldson's 31. I mean, these, you can't win with guys in their 30s. I mean, every now and again, you'll have a team of guys that are in their young 30s and they'll surprise everybody and play, you know, well. But generally speaking, that's just the wrong way to go. And so I think that's what happened to them. I don't get any pleasure. I actually kind of like them. I get a huge kick out of Jose Bautista. I really do. I think he's funny, he's a hothead, he's awesome, I get a huge kick out of him, so I get no pleasure out of them falling apart. But I'm all for nostalgia, so if nostalgia makes you happy, that, you know, if you were happier when the Blue Jays were bad and that takes you back to that point in life, there's nothing wrong with that. If that's what you want, that's fine.
I think you're right. I it bums me out that group, that core group, all got old at the same time. That's what bums me out.
Oh, no, I agree with that. It always bums me out. It always bums me out when a team, like, suddenly, you know, even I never had any special affinity for that Phillies team that won in 2000.
The Chase Utley, Ryan Howard group.
Right, they won in 2008, made it back in 2009, right, and lost the Yankees. And then they put together that incredible pitching staff in 2011 that just never quite came together, and they lost in the playoffs, and then they fell apart. I never had any great affinity for that team, but it still bummed me out when they got old. I mean, because it's like, you know, it's just watching time go by. Suddenly Ryan Howard's terrible and Chase Utley's no good and Jimmy Rollins is no good. And I don't like that.
Of all of the terrible contracts that have ever been written up and signed, that 5-year, $125 million dollar extension for Howard before his deal was even up, that's going to go down in history as top five worst all time, right?
Oh, I think it might be the worst, because don't forget, I mean, your point is right. It wasn't before his deal got up. It was a year and a half before his deal came up. And he was already no good.
Yeah.
I mean, he was good, but he was not, you know, he was all home runs and RBIs by the time that they signed that deal. And anybody who, you know, is in the game knows that those are not, you don't look at those numbers. And he already was, and he was hurt, you know, he got hurt before the contract kicked in because they gave it to him so much earlier. Yeah, it was a terrible, terrible contract.
What's crazy, though? We should at some point in this podcast, we should draft contracts. We should draft athlete contracts.
Good contracts or bad ones?
I don't know. It's up to you. But but I sometimes think about that, the Mike Hampton deal from whatever it was now, 15, 20 years ago, how bad a deal that was and still would have been. Like that, even with inflation, if you did that deal now, that deal would have been bad. It was $100 million for the Rockies, right? For, what was it, like 8 years?
Yeah,
or 6 years with like a 2-year option or something. And
it was awful.
And it was like, that is still would have been a terrible deal 15, 20 years later.
That's an all-time deal too. Yeah. Oh, I mean, there are a lot of good ones. We'll do that draft. All right, let me go on to some questions here. Jeremy asked this question. I think it's a good one. What's next for Kyle Schwarber? All right, that's the question.
Great question.
And there are two things I want to point out. One, and I mean, there's not even enough money on earth for me to have bet against this. There's one Chicago Cubs player in the All-Star game, and it's Wade Davis.
It's so crazy. It's the crazy, and no starters. Not a single starter. They sent their entire
single everyday player on that team.
They sent their entire infield and one outfielder last year, and two starting pitchers. And so they had seven, basically seven guys who could have started the All-Star game. And this year there's one, and it's a reliever who wasn't on the team last year.
Wasn't even on the team last year. So that's crazy. Kyle Schwarber fascinates me for a couple of reasons, but the two main reasons that he fascinates me are, one, they threw him into the leadoff spot right away before the year began. And I think all of us, including, I think both of us, thought, yeah, that'll work, right? I mean, the way Schwarber hit in the postseason, his background, his sense of him. I mean, nobody knew how he's going to play in the field and all the other stuff. But as far as leadoff, like we all thought, yeah, that's going to work. And it was a disastrous decision, just a bomb of epic proportions. And the second thing is that I think all of us kind of assumed Kyle Schwarber was a star when he had not really done any star-like things other than his sort of epic few games in the postseason. And I don't know why we jumped the gun on both of those things. I don't know why the Cubs felt like he was going to be absolutely ready to handle the leadoff spot. And I don't know why all of us sort of put him in. I mean, you would hear people talking about Cubs stars and they would be like, yeah, Rizzo, Bryant, Schwarber. Well, Schwarber didn't do anything to get into that spot yet. And so what I've seen this year is that it's a healthy reminder that, yeah, the Cubs were fantastic last year and everything went right and it turned out great, but that doesn't change the laws of physics, right? I mean, it's like Kyle Schwarber still has to actually prove that he's a good Major League Baseball player before we can start calling him a good Major League Baseball player.
Yeah, but the guy has been a world-class hitter probably since he was three at every level.
That's right.
And then he got to the majors, and he hit a bunch of home runs, and then he got a terrible injury, and he came back after the terrible injury in the most high-pressure situation you can possibly do that, and just raked for a week. So it's not like – I don't think he was jumping the gun to declare the guy a star. He sure looked like a star. I mean, he'd only played in 100 games or something, but he looked like a star. And this kind of thing that happened to him – it happens to people. It happens to a lot of people who are great hitters and have great careers. By the way, since he's been at Iowa, he's raking. He hit two home runs in a game last night. He hit two home runs in a game the night before. The one of the home runs that he hit last night cleared the scoreboard in right center field and went out of the. I mean, and people lost their. There's a funny video of it. You can watch online. What's next for Kyle Schwarber is he's going to come back to the majors and rake. That's what's happened. I really don't think this is not a guy forgot how to play kind of a deal. It's also not a everybody jumped the gun, Jeff Francoeur type situation. This guy has always been a patient and excellent hitter. He hits the ball the other way. He hits the ball out the other way. He's a stud, and he's gonna be fine. I just you want to get through this as fast as you can, because the longer it goes on, the longer it's a topic of discussion. And now that Chicago, after last year, is the center of the baseball universe, there's more pressure on him right now.
Right.
And there's more attention being paid to him than there should be.
And that's what I mean by jump the gun. I don't mean jump the gun that he's a good hitter. He's a good hitter, and he's going to hit big time in the big leagues. I have very little doubt about that. But I do think we jumped the gun in putting him in the leadoff spot, putting all this pressure on him, assuming that he was going to be one of the studs of the game. he hadn't done that yet. He had not really done that for any extended period of time in the big leagues. Even when he came up in the, you know, when he first came up, he did hit a bunch of home runs, but he still showed a big hole in his swing. And look, he can't, he's not, they don't really have a defensive position for him. I mean, there are issues with him that I think needed to be sort of sorted out. And maybe it's impossible. Maybe because the Cubs won the World Series last year and he had a good World Series, and he's, you know, and the hype has been around him forever, maybe we had to jump the gun. I just saying that it did him a great disservice to put him in the leadoff spot, assume everything was going to work out great, because I don't know that he was there mentally. I just don't know that he was there. I think he'll be back really soon, and I think he will hit. I think this is going to be great for him, but in my view, it should have been handled a little bit differently.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
All right, here is a question, 1 to 10 from Nick Vega. He's asking us 1 to 10. How overrated are 4th of July fireworks? I don't know if 1 is like, what is it? So, like, on a 1 to 10, how overrated? Would 10 be the most overrated and 1 would be the least overrated?
Yeah, I would say 10 is like, the 10 is overrated the way that, like, red convertibles are overrated, which is, like, the most right, overrated you can right. be, and 1 is overrated the way that, you know, Jose Altuve is overrated, which is to say not at all.
Not at all. Yeah, I'd say 10. The fireworks are, I hate fireworks.
You say straight 10.
10. Well, look, and again, now let's differentiate. Love fireworks in a professional setting. Like if you go to a ball game after the game is over and fireworks, or you go to a park and they have like a firework display. Love those. Those are great. Like you go with your kids. Those are awesome. Backyard fireworks where people just shooting off fireworks and hurting themselves and bothering my dog and doing all that sort of, hate them, can't stand them.
Overrated. Oh, well, that goes without saying. I mean, yeah. Backyard fireworks are the dumbest. It's the one, it's like, I don't know what has to happen for us as a people. It, you know, I've often felt, I've made a statement every year for the past 10 years, and I believe it to be true. And that statement is this: we will never truly advance as a society until the concept of Black Friday is no longer a thing. I really believe that's true. I think that when you think about what Black Friday is, it's a, everyone is home, you're with your friends and your family for Thanksgiving, you're celebrating a timeless ritual, you know, that dates back to the founding of this great nation. Sure. And then people go to giant stores and basically try to murder each other to get a $30 discount on a flat screen TV at like 5 p.m. on Thursday. And I really believe that things won't truly get better. We won't feel like we're evolving and progressing until Black Friday, until we come together as one and decide we should not do Black Friday anymore. That should go away. So the same could be said, I think, of backyard fireworks, right? Until we'd say as a people, hey, we're no longer going to buy illegal fireworks, or sometimes legal, depending on what state you're in, light them off in our backyards, make our neighbors angry, make every dog in a half mile radius go crazy, usually get really badly injured, blow off a finger, get badly burned, have kids be put in harm's way, all for the sake of what exactly, I can't quite tell, a loud noise in that's near you. Until we decide that we're no longer going to do that, I don't think we're ever going to truly get better. Like the idea of alien life in the universe coming and finding us somewhere, like if they looked around and the first two things that they witnessed were backyard fireworks and Black Friday, they would just turn around and go home. In fact, maybe that's what's happened. Maybe they've already come and they were like, let's go see what these life forms are up to. And they watched a bunch of people set off backyard fireworks and go to the emergency room. And then they watched a Black Friday sale at a Target and the way that we behaved. And they were like, yeah, there's nothing here for us. We're leaving. And they turned around and went home. They went on their 7 million light year journey back to their home planet and reported back that we were not worth the trouble. That, I believe, is what has happened.
I think that happened. I think they were staying at a hotel and they went and they said, I'd like to stay on the 13th floor. And they said, we don't have one.
We don't have. They said, why? And they said, because it's bad luck. And they said, but your 14th floor is your 13th floor. And they said, yes. And they were like, all right, we're out of here. But so I wouldn't say I don't know if I would go 10, because I think there's some value in watching fireworks displays. that are professionally done.
Yeah. That's right.
But they are overrated. I'll say 8. I'll say 8.3. That's my ranking.
That's good. I'm actually, as if we're splitting it like that, I would do that. I agree. I think you're right. Yeah, 8.1 range, I think, is good.
These rankings are the amount they're overrated is accurate to a tenth of a point.
All right, we have several more questions, but I'm going to stop real quick and thank our second sponsor of the podcast, which is Volvo. Volvo sponsors the podcast, and for Volvo, we don't freelance, we don't mess around. I'm just going to read the ad they gave to me, and again, I'm going to ask you if you would to judge how I do on this read.
On okay, a scale of 1 to 10, and it'll be accurate
to a tenth of a point. If you could, yes. Here we go. After a long, dark winter, every Swede looks forward to Midsommar, and now Volvo is giving America a reason to look forward to it, too. Join us for our Midsommar sales event and get up to $4,500 off on select Volvo vehicles. Enjoy standard features like keyless entry, rear park assist camera, navigation system, and more. But hurry, summer doesn't last forever. Take advantage of this limited time offer today. Visit your local Volvo dealer for detail. Offer excludes all V90, XC90 Momentum, and XC90 Excellence. Standard features vary by model. See your dealer for details. All right, here we go. Here we go. This is a good one for you. How is Drew Pomeranz the Red Sox second best starter?
There's a couple of reasons. One is the other starters have been worse than Drew Pomeranz. That's probably
that's the first reason. Let's get that out of the way.
That's probably the main thing. You know, here's the thing about Drew Pomeranz. Drew Pomeranz was a good pitcher. For the Padres. Yeah, he was a good pitcher. And granted, he was pitching in Petco. And, you know, it's easy to pitch in Petco. But he was good. And he doesn't, you know, he's not like, he doesn't look menacing. And he doesn't throw particularly hard. And he kind of he's like a dork. Drew Pomeranz is kind of a dorky pitcher. And so I think he's a little bit underrated. But he had good numbers. And, you know, this year he's been a little bit unlucky. But he's pitched pretty well. He has 92 strikeouts and 27 walks, which isn't bad. It's a little bit too many walks, but 92 strikeouts and 84 innings, that's a good ratio. And his whip is a little high. It's 1.32. But, like, he's a pretty good third starter. He is not the problem. The problem, obviously, is that Price and Porcello have been straight up bad. Price has also been a little bit unlucky. But he has not been David Price. He wasn't David Price last year either, really. Porcello has just been bad. Porcello has his control numbers are fine. Porcello has given up 17 home runs in 100 innings. That's not good. And his massive regression is probably the single biggest problem with the team, I would say, because what's the crazy thing is the Red Sox have been a mess. They don't have a single player started with a 900 OPS, which after last year, the way that offense worked, you would think like, oh, they're here we go. This team is going to keep who will, they lost Ortiz. Who cares? They're going to keep clicking, but they've lost. They don't have that. I guess now Mookie is probably after last night. No, maybe he isn't. He's close to 900, but their offense is like coming around. But it's been a mess, and their pitching's been kind of a mess, and they're in first place by three games in the East, and they have the second best record in the American League. So, like, the woes of the pitching staff and the hitters are being compensated for. And what you would hope if you're a Red Sox fan is that all of the garbage play is out of their system, and that now they're clicking a little bit more offensively. You would hope that Price and Porcello have better second halves than they have first halves. But I'll tell you, Drew Pomeranz is not the problem.
No, not at all. I would disagree with you a little bit on Porcello. I think Porcello's been kind of unlucky. I think he's been hit unlucky. I mean, his strikeout to walk is really good, and FIP is under 4. I mean, it's not. He's definitely regressed, but he's not pitching that much worse. I think he's been unlucky. I think David Price is a mess. He's just a mess. I mean, mentally, physically, emotionally, I don't know what the hell. I mean, I love the guy. I do. I've always loved David Price. I think he's been terrific. I think he's brilliant. You know, he's super duper smart and just a guy that that to me was, you know, was one of the great stars of the game. And you know, whether it's the injuries, his trouble, you know, clearly he's not pitching well. The way he's handled the media has been horrendous, and clearly, you know, he's got rabbit ears at this point. I mean, he's definitely listening to what's happening. I think that's a real problem. I mean, the Red Sox are going to be fine. I think the big part of the thing has been that they have just went through a very long stretch of time where they couldn't score runs. I mean, that's weird. Yeah. and inexplicable, really. But it was just a stretch of time, and now they're coming out of that. That bullpen is really good, and Kimbrel's amazing, and Sale. I mean, we should talk a little more about Sale, because he's the guy. I, you know, it's funny, because with strikeouts up all around baseball, you know, anybody you go out there, you can see throw, you know, strike out 10 in a game. I mean, that's just not that big a deal anymore. I mean, it's still great, but it's you know, it's so common that it's not that big a deal anymore. And somehow, even with that in mind, and even with guys like Max Scherzer and Clayton Kershaw and awesome, I don't think there's anybody more like overwhelming at the moment than Chris Sale is. Just as
no, there's a couple guys every year where you wonder how anyone
right
to hit, like, literally how does anyone hit him ever, and like ever. This year it's Sale and Scherzer, I think, are the two guys that for me where you watch them and you're like, oh, no one can, how does anyone get a hit off that guy? And you know, in past years you've had Strasburg, you've had Pedro, you've had whoever. But this year, it's Chris Sale. He's the guy when you look at his stuff. And by the way, I have to pause for 1 second. As a nation, we take Clayton Kershaw for granted, and we should stop taking him for granted.
That's why the aliens went back.
I mean, Sale, because what Sale is, Sale struck out Josh Donaldson the other day looking on a slider. And Josh Donaldson looked back at him after he struck out. He caught him looking. And I think he struck him out 3 times in the game. And he caught him looking. And Donaldson looked out at Chris Sale like, what are you – how did you do that?
Stop. Don't do that.
Yeah, and it was wonderful. So I watched that and really enjoyed it. And then I watched Clayton Kershaw pitch and he's in the game. He struck out Eric Young Jr. on 3 pitches. It's like in the 4th or 5th inning of a game. The last time Kershaw pitched, go try to find video of it if you can. It was a 3-pitch sequence. It was a fastball, a curveball, and a changeup or a slider. I can't remember which. And it was like it was so sad. I felt so bad for Eric Young Jr. He's one of the best baseball players in the world, and he's made it to the majors, and he has a bright future. And it just felt unfair of him to have to face Clayton Kershaw in that moment. It was the craziest 3-pitch. I actually tweeted about it. I tweeted and said that was the craziest 3-pitch sequence I have ever seen in my life. And it's so fun to watch those guys. And you know, Sale has almost single-handedly propped up the entire Red Sox team. I mean, he's whatever he is. He's 11-2 now or something. And he's 11-3. Two of his losses, he lost to the Phillies 1-0. He threw 8 innings, gave up 4 hits and 1 run, and struck out 10 and lost. And then the other loss recently was a 3-2 loss to Oakland, where he pitched 7 innings and gave up 2 runs and struck out 10. And it's like when Pedro was pitching in 99 or 2000. It's like the only way he would lose is 1-0. Or that Bob Gibson year when he was lost 12 games and, you know, 8 of them were 1-0 games or whatever. It really does feel like the way to beat him is 1-0 or 2-1, and that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are a couple of things. One, you talk about Kershaw. I think Kershaw and Mike Trout, it's the same thing. It's like, we don't want to just talk about just them, you know, but if you really are talking about the best of the best, you just talk about them, you know, but we don't want that. We want to be able to expand it and talk about Max Scherzer and Bryce Harper and Chris Sale and all these others. So it does feel in some ways like we forget them. I mean, Clayton Kershaw has been doing what Chris Sale's doing now for like 7 years now, right? I mean, he's just been, you know, he's just doing. That said, the second thing is, I think Sale's dominance feels different. What Kershaw does is so, it's like the closest thing you can get to like perfection, right? Because one thing that he does is he tunnels everything, so he throws every pitch out of the same exact spot and exact windup, and so you're like, you have no chance against him because you have no idea what's coming, and it's like he's like a wizard, you know. And Sale is not a wizard. Sale is just like, yeah, if I could throw a pitch like that, I'd be really good too. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, it's the purity of his pitches. It's like that slider is so ridiculous. It's like the greatest slider I've ever seen. I mean, yeah. You know, it's crazy to say that. I mean, you talk about all the great sliders in baseball history, but that slider starts here and ends up like 10 feet away, and then sometimes it doesn't. And it moves differently. It like has some sort of weird knuckleball quality where it seems to move differently on different batters. I mean, it's, you know, it's like the Randy Johnson slider times two or something. I mean, it's
he's also part of it is also that he's like 6'6", and he weighs less than I do. Right. I don't know if that means anything to anybody, but he's so skinny. He's like a whip. The entire like his physical body. His physical presence is that of a whip that's whipping a ball at you. So it's like it's coming from this crazy angle. He sort of throws three-quarter. His windup is herky-jerky and kind of like he's just a guy who runs up to the mound. He looks scary. He whips his giant frame around. He whips his giant arm around, and the ball comes at an impossible angle and dives in this impossible way. It feels very unfair. It feels extremely unfair to hitters. And he can also control it incredibly well. He can throw that slider that bends around the outer edge of the plate. He can bury it down by your feet. He can, you know, and then his fastball is like, you know, in the mid upper 90s. And so if you start looking for the slider, then he just busts you high and tight with a fastball, and you're dead. So yeah, he has I don't understand how he's hittable. I don't understand how anybody ever gets a hit off him.
Well, that's it. And you're right. The same thing is true about Max Scherzer, except for Max Scherzer will have like just weird, like one inning reprieves where he'll give hitters. Cause he'll be, I mean, Max Scherzer seems to go into the eighth inning with perfect games like every other day. Right. I mean, it's just like, it's constantly. Well,
did you see the stat? Did you see the stat where he's taken like 15% of his starts with the Nationals have been no hitters through six or something? It's like, it's only like 12%. It's like basically one out of every six or seven starts that he's had for the Nationals he's had a no hitter through the sixth inning.
I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then every so often he'll give up like back-to-back homers or something. It's like he gets into weird funks, or he has the kind of pitches where like you either hit him for home runs or you don't hit him at all. I mean, it's weird. I mean, he's like, it's a little bit weird. Sale feels more like unhittable to me. I mean, they're both unhittable. But again, it's just like there's something about Sale that's like scary. He's like kind of, you know, the motion is sort of a little bit wild. So I would be scared to death to step in there against him anyway. He's amazing. He's amazing. Yeah. All right. Matthew Goodman wants to know what's wrong with the Mets with three question marks. What's wrong with the Mets? Matthew, I mean, I think three Mets got hurt while I read that tweet. So
that's right.
That's what's wrong with the Mets, right? They can't stay healthy. Their incredible rotation is like all in the hospital at this moment.
Yeah. That specifically, their pitchers are all hurt. That's right. I mean, it couldn't be more simply described than that. It's they have a ton of good pitchers, and every single one of them is hurt. And Matt Harvey, you would have had an asterisk, is hurt / a crazy head case. And
I'd love to be on the DL, crazy head case.
Here's the, just right now, here are the people on the DL for the Mets. I just looked it up. Conforto's on the 10-day DL. Familia's on the 60-day DL. Matt Harvey's on the 10-day DL. Tommy Malone's on the 60-day DL. Lagares is on the 10-day DL. Josh Smoker's on the 10-day DL. Syndergaard's on the 60-day DL. David Wright is on the 60-day DL. Neil Walker's on the 10-day DL. You're just never going to win. Yeah, you're never going to win when you have your closer, three of your starters, the best player in the last 30 years of your franchise. They're all out essentially for the year. I mean, who has actually played this year for them besides Cespedes, who's any good? Who's like DeGrom. One of their star players? Yeah, DeGrom. That's right. He's the last one, right? Yeah. Last one standing.
No, it's crazy. I mean, the injuries have just blown them out of the water. Matt Harvey, he is a crazy head case. I watch him pitch the time before they put him on the DL. And by the way, putting him on the 10-day DL is like, what's the point of that? I mean, he clearly is hurt, like pretty badly hurt. Or his stuff is just gone. I mean, it could be one or the other. And, you know, you think back to that moment in game five of the 2015 World Series, ninth inning, they have the lead against the Royals. Manager, you know, is ready to take him out of the game. He's like, you're not taking me out of the game. And the fans are all chanting his name. And he hadn't been the same since. I mean, it's just like that moment is, you know, and you couldn't blame him at that time. I blame the manager. I mean, once you've made the decision to pull him out of the game, you got to pull him out of the game. I mean, I don't think you can.
Yeah,
you can let him, you know, do that. But
I mean, it's also like that might be. It's also probably, you know, it's not. I don't think that the answer is that he was psychologically damaged or something. I mean, he this year in 70 innings, he has 54 strikeouts and 35 walks, which is not very good. Brutal. And he's given up 16 homers in 70 innings. I mean, you're talking, that's a 50 homer year if you pitch 200 innings like that. You know, he's got an injury and he has rabbit ears and is a head case. And until he can screw his head on tight, I don't think he's ever going to be the Matt Harvey we used to know.
All right, two more questions. One from Bill. Between 00 and 99, what is the uniform number of a baseball player that lets you know that he is a scrub? what is the ultimate scrub number? That's a good question. Good question.
Well, I mean, in spring training, you're given numbers. If you're called up to the majors for spring training, you're given a very high number usually, right? So, you know, if you see a guy wearing like 75 or something, you know that guy is like sort of a long shot to make the team. Right. And then if they do make the team, they'll move down to a lower number, but sometimes they keep them. Like, didn't Barry Zito kept he had a crazy high uniform number, I think. I could be wrong.
I think that's right.
But Aaron Judge is 99. So it's not, there isn't one number, but I think anything in like the 60s, you know, like
60s are bad.
Who's the best baseball player who ever had a number in the 60s? Ooh. Like, oh, Puig. Puig is 66, so there's someone. But I can't. It's very few. I mean, it's like, you know, if you're in the 60s or the 70s, I think you're. I would say the lowest number. What's the highest number where you're still a star? That's it. Maybe a better question.
48.
Yeah, I would have said 49 maybe.
Yeah, wasn't 49 like, even. You could be 49. Yeah.
One of those wasn't. What was Tom Seaver?
Tom Seaver was. I should know this right off the top of my head, and I do not. Is he 42? No, no, he wasn't 42. He was 40. He was 41.
I'm gonna look it up. He was 41. 41. Okay, 41. So he was 41. Bob Gibson was 45.
Right.
So yeah, and I feel like someone was Tim Wakefield was 49. So maybe not a star, but like a legit Hall of Fame, major leaguer. I feel like there's someone who's 50.
I don't know. Is that true?
We're both looking it up at the same time.
Yeah, we're looking it up like, oh yeah, so. Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea.
Oh, Oral Hershiser. Wasn't Oral Hershiser number 50? Or something like that? Yeah. Anyway, I would say if you're in the 60s, you're probably not great. Most people, except for Puig is 60, so or 66 rather.
Oh, well, so. Wait a minute. I just found something that actually gives us some numbers. 53, Don Drysdale was 53.
That's pretty good. All right.
And I did remember that 72 is Carlton Fisk. So you can, there are ways to go up. I think in the 60s, generally, not great. I think 60s are just generally not really good. So, all right.
Also, I'm reading here that 49 has been Charlie Huff, Tim Wakefield, and Tom Candiotti. So I guess I love that. So I'll bet like Huff picked it first, and then Candiotti picked it as a tribute to Huff, and then Wakefield picked it as a tribute to both of them. That would be my guess.
I love it. Dave Mallow wants to know, how do I explain to my friends that hot fruit is garbage if I am not as articulate as Michael?
Wow. Great question.
Not a great question, Dave.
Great
not.
Question. It's a great question. I would say the simplest way to do it, and the areas in which I've had the most success making this point, involve thought experiments where you just say, like, would you rather eat a, like, a hot, imagine a hot plate of blueberries, and now imagine a regular cold plate of blueberries. What would you rather eat? And then pointing out that, like, the people have had the wool pulled over their eyes by Big Pie, which Big is pie. The name that I've given the pie industry in this country. And they've made you believe that fruit pies are delicious, and they're not actually delicious. They're sugary. They're full of sugar, and they have flaky, buttery pastry. But it's just a sugar delivery system. It's not actually the pie you want to eat. You want to eat a pecan pie or maybe a pumpkin pie. Side note, please don't tell me pumpkin is a fruit. And the thought experiment of, like, doesn't a delicious, crunchy, crispy, cold apple sound good? Yes, it does. It sounds better than a mealy, mushy, disgusting hot apple baked into a pastry. It's a sense thing. It's like, if you actually think about it, if you actually picture in your head, if you visualize the difference between eating that delicious, crispy, crunchy, cold apple, fresh apple, versus like a mealy, mushy, gross, cinnamon-y, gross, awful, heated apple, you'll see that you actually prefer the cold apple. So I would do thought experiments. That's what I would do.
I'm not even going to go with you there. Although I will point out that more than one person has written in to say that, as the world's leading expert on peanut butter and jelly, you do know that that they had to heat that fruit in order to make the jelly.
It's such a lame argument, though. It's such a it's such a dumb argument. You're eating that fruit cold. Like
well, what if you want a cold pie? Then are you opposed to cold pie?
I know it's better than hot pie, but it's still not good because it's loaded up with sugar. Like preserves that you put on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you don't have to add extra sugar to if you don't want to. And I prefer the ones that aren't added sugar, or like a very small amount of added sugar. But when you're eating, my point about pie is that you think the apples or the blueberries are what you like about the pie. They're not. You like the buttery pastry, and you like the sugar, the massive amount of extra sugar, and the fruit is just a filling. It's not even, you're not even enjoying the fruit. You're just, it's like the oil in your car.
It's like the oil in your car. I'm not even going to argue with you. All right.
It's actually, except it tastes worse than oil.
Ephus Pitch wants to know, I hope you guys talk about the NBA offseason. It's so ridiculous and entertaining. Are you entertained by all the movement here in the NBA offseason?
I actually am. I'm very entertained by it. I will say that it saddens me a little because there's now a major league basketball league, which is the West, and there's a minor league basketball league, which is the East. And as a fan of a team that plays in the East, I know we should be happy about that because the Celtics' path to the finals would be theoretically easier now that literally LeBron is the only, the only top 15 player in the NBA by most metrics is now in the East. I mean, it's really sad. Like Millsap going to the Nuggets. It's like, for God's sake, can anyone stay in the East?
Anybody.
I mean, anybody, every single team. And that's why, like, Paul George going West, like, I was happy for the Thunder, I guess, because, you know, they've had a tough couple of years.
Sure.
But at the same time, it's like when the talent drain is just horrible. Like, what is the All-Star team going to be next year? The Western Conference All-Star team, I'll bet this will be an interesting thing. Let's revisit this in 6 months or 8 months or whatever it is. What is a better team next year? The Eastern Conference All-Star team, or a team you could make out of players in the West who are not All-Stars? Because there are going to be three or four at least world-class players who simply can't make the Western Conference All-Star team, right? You're going to have like an insane, you're going to have like a, like an incredible team made up of guys who couldn't even make the All-Star team.
No question. No question.
And I'll bet you anything, it would be a competitive game. Because you'd have, in the East, obviously, you're going to have LeBron and you'll have whoever. You'll have Isaiah Thomas and you'll have whoever. But you're going to have a better, I'll bet you'll have a better all-around team made of guys. Like someone like Anthony Davis is like,
oh,
going
to
not make the All-Star team next year.
It's crazy. No, I totally agree. I think the East would win against like the second team All-Star team, right? The second All-Star team in the West. I think the East would win because of LeBron. But it would be like LeBron would have to play.
He'd have to play really hard, yeah.
Yeah, he'd have to play 46 minutes in order for them to win because the rest of the team would be way better in the West. I don't like that. I don't like that the East has just become, because it's been bad for a few years now. It's been, it really is paved the way for LeBron's run. And I'm, LeBron, we've discussed this. We both think LeBron's the greatest player ever. But it still paved the way. He doesn't go to 7 straight or 8 straight or whatever it is if he's in the West, no matter how good his team is around him, So it really has paved the way a little bit for LeBron, and it's kind of sad that one player can basically be good enough to win a conference. No matter how good that player is, one player shouldn't be good enough to just win the conference the way that LeBron has won the last few years. So that part is sad. All right, well, I like this. I like this little question thing where we take questions.
I do, too.
That's fun. All right, it's time for one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing.
It's one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing. We talk about sports and we draft things we know, like how beaches are terrible places to go. No hot fruit for Michael, more Diet Coke for Joe. The podcast, whoa, it's one last whoa, meaningless thing.
And, do you want to go first, or do I go first? What are we doing?
I'll go first. Last meaningless thing was I bought a new pair of shoes recently, and I was lacing them up for the first time, and I had the thought that the shoelace is an item that is essentially exactly as functional and good at its job now as it was 200 years ago or whenever it was invented. Like it's a thing that like someone figured it out. It was the right move to invent the shoelace. And it's basically the same. It's no different now. It's exactly as effective now. There's been no significant advancement in it, right?
Velcro.
Well, but that's not a shoelace. I'm saying the actual shoelace. Like the concept of fastening shoes has had advances that are optional, but I don't even think, I think Velcro is, I prefer shoelaces. Velcro is good for kids, but the actual shoelace, the thing itself, you can't really improve upon, and you haven't improved upon, and it's basically exactly as good now as it was hundreds of years ago. That's kind of cool. I like that.
I totally agree. Totally agree. I kind of have a similar one. We just ended up kind of having a similar one. My one last meaningless thing is tape measures are pretty great still. They're still pretty great. Now, there are new ways now where you can do with your phone where you can, like, press a button to know how far. But we went out to buy a couch for my parents a couple of weeks ago, and, we needed to know how big is the couch or how wide is it, and all that sort of thing. And we had a tape measure, just an old-fashioned tape measure. That thing is brilliantly designed. It's brilliantly designed. You just pull it out. You have that little button, that little red button that holds it in place, measures exactly perfectly done. And then it just zips right back in and is in your hand. And yeah, I think the tape measure is a fantastic invention. And I prefer it to the whatever newfangled little
like laser thingy or whatever.
Yeah. If I'm building a house, I'd probably want I want like exact precise measurement. But for your everyday, I just need to know how long that is or whatever. Tape measure is still awesome.
I like it. We ended up in the same general area of meaninglessness.
Well, I really wanted to work on it because you remember the last couple of times you felt those things were a little too meaningful.
Yeah, that's right. We've been edging toward meaning, and I think it's a huge mistake, and we need to scramble back away from meaning into the dark, inky void of meaninglessness.
Well, because we're not good with meaningful. That's just not really our strong suit.
Come on. Come on. If we start swimming in that pool, I think we're dead.
We're dead. This podcast ends tomorrow if we're trying to be meaningful. So, all right. Well, as always, Michael, thank you.
Thanks for having me.